Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, a super smart correspondent for Time Magazine shares myriad facts and statistics about the effectiveness of female leadership. Did you know only 5% of Fortune 1000 CEOs and 17% of corporate board members in general are women? Author J. Newton Small found evidence that the dearth of women in positions of power actually hurts business and our political system. Her new book is Broad Influence: How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. She spoke at Town Hall Seattle on June 13th. We're presenting the core of her talk here, and that's only about 20 minutes long. She went on to take many questions from the audience afterwards. You can hear the extended and great conversation on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
Thank you so much to Town Hall for having me here. I'm really excited to be here in Seattle and the home of Patty Murray, as as was noted. I actually have a whole chapter on Patty Murray in the book, so there you go. I originally got the idea to write this book about 2.5 years ago during the government shutdown. And I wrote a story for Time about the women of the Senate coming together during the government shutdown to restart the negotiations to reopen the government when none of the men would talk to each other. And I had a lot of interest in writing a book out of that on the women of the Senate, but the women of the Senate were all writing their own books and didn't need one from me. But what interested me most about it was that it was the first time the Senate was 20% women. And as someone who'd covered the Senate on and off for the better part of 13, 14 years at that point, you could really feel the difference. It was like a tangible difference of the feeling of the Senate, how it was run, what they did. And indeed, they ended up actually producing 75% of the legislation that was signed into law in that 2-year period. So they had a huge impact. It was really amazing. And so I got really interested in the idea of critical mass. So the idea that somewhere between 20 and 30% in any body, whether it's a legislative body like the Senate or a corporate board, a Navy ship or an appellate court, women really begin to change the sort of feeling, they change the culture of an institution, and they begin to change the way things are done. So what really inspired me first off was I had more mail in response to that particular story than I'd ever had in response to any story I'd ever written for Time, and that includes 2 cover stories and Sarah Palin, so that tells you something. And a lot of the letters that women wrote to me talked about how they were experiencing something similar in their careers and in their fields, this kind of tipping point. And so I had a woman from the Navy who wrote to me about how on Navy ships, they mandated that all that women had to be at least 20% with a goal of 25% on all Navy ships. And they first integrated the ships with officers, female officers, so that the men could get used to taking orders from women and respecting women, and then they brought in the rank and file. And she said that this had happened because after the Navy was ordered to integrate in 1973 by the Supreme Court, they tried and failed to really bring women in, you know, by bringing first in one woman, then a handful of women, and then ultimately they sort of almost struck upon critical mass as accidentally and realized that this is the way to do it. I had a letter from a woman who worked for the 30% Club in New York City, which is a group that actually aims to get 30% women on corporate boards throughout America. And she said there's so much research that they had done, and it was amazing, compelling research that showed that you shouldn't just have women, you know, brought into your companies or have women's programs in your companies for the PR effect of it, but you should have women's programs because they were so effective. Women brought, like, having 30% women on your board made your company 26% more efficient. You had to restate your earnings 55% less. There were 2 studies, some of my favorite studies that I looked at, where having 30% women on your board actually made the male board members come to the meetings more prepared because the women were so much better prepared. And they were 45% more profitable. I mean, who would not want that for your company, to have it 45% more profitable? And so it was all this amazing research that showed this, like, compelling case of why you should have diversity on your board, why you should have more women in your company. And yet companies were only doing it as kind of PR things, like, right? Like, we support women, whatever. So I thought it would be really amazing to collect all the areas where women were reaching critical mass and sort of show where they were making a difference and the difference that they made, and then sort of illustrate why you should have more women on these in everything, in your board, in your legislature, everywhere. One of the first big surprises I had in collecting all this research was that the public sector actually is reaching critical mass in all three branches of the government. So Congress is 20% women. The administration is 30% women in terms of upper-level civil service and political appointees. And the federal bench is actually 36% women, and 40% of state judges are actually women. So they've made a lot of progress in the public sector, but the private sector has actually fallen behind. In the last decade, they've stalled at 17% corporate board representation and about 20 to 21% representation in executive suite workforces. So I was curious, why was the public sector doing better versus the private sector? And there are a bunch of reasons for this. One, women tend to self-select to the public sector because if you're going to miss your kids' soccer games, if you're going to miss tucking them in at night, you wanted to be feeling like you were making the world a better place for them. Two, unions were actually a lot stronger in the public sector than they were the private sector, and so women's jobs are better protected after they left for maternity leave. And three, the on-ramping in the public sector is actually better for women. So if you look at New Hampshire, one of my favorite states, not just because it votes early, but it is actually the most representative democracy in the nation. So the lower house in New Hampshire is 400 people who represent 3 million people, right? So it's a very tiny leap from running for a school board to running for state legislature because you literally represent like 100 more people. New Hampshire, because of this, it's one of 36 states in the union where being in the state legislature is a part-time job. And so for women joining the state legislature, you could have young kids, you could sort of do it, you know, part-time, and then as your kids got older, you could take on more responsibility and you could start chairing committees, running for higher office. And in New Hampshire, this has led women to become in the last 5 years not only the governor, the lieutenant governor, half the state senate, but the entire congressional delegation has been women. So it's been a very successful way for women to come into the workforce, particularly in the public sector. The place where women struggled the most in both the private sector and the public sector was actually executive office, which I thought was really interesting. So all the things that help women get elected to legislatures, like or to corporate boards, frankly, the idea that women, and you can never say that women are monolithic, right? Women are always going to be, you know, there's always going to be some women who are more aggressive and some women who are more risk-taking. But generally speaking, studies show that women are better at consensus building. They're better at win-win scenarios and finding, like Patty Murray did in the chapter that I write about her with Paul Ryan, an end to the fiscal cliffs, you know, looking for a win-win and a lose-lose for everybody on board and therefore not trying to, like, kind of kill your enemy thing. Unfortunately, executive office requires killing your enemy. It requires talents in win-loss scenarios and zero-sum games and really command and control decision-making in ways that require little input from others. And so women are perceived, rightly or wrongly, to be not very good at executive offices. So that's why there are so few women in them in America. So less than, actually about 5.1% now of the Fortune 1000 companies have female CEOs. Only 6 of the nation's 50 governors have women at their heads. And 17% of mayors in America are women. And so it is the hardest glass ceiling for women to break. And I think you see that right now in the election, right? We've never had a woman who's been at the top of the ticket of a political party, and only now with Hillary Clinton has this actually broken through. In interviewing women, successful women, sort of CEOs and candidates for executive office, they talked a lot, and in fact, I interviewed your governor here, thanks to my friend Lars, who used to work for her, Christine Gregoire, who's here tonight, for this book, and she talked about being running for executive office and the challenges that females face or that women face. And so the first time you run for office, you are perceived as not tough enough. You're not capable enough. So women face a capability test in running for executive office they don't face for any other office. And so you have to prove yourself capable. You have to prove yourself tough enough. You have to show that you can, you know, have your finger on the button at that time of the month and, like, not nuke Russia. And They also, though, had to, it's a very thin needle to thread to also show that you're still likable at the same time. And so Christine Gregoire actually talked a lot about how the first time she ran for governor, she really had to show she was capable, show she was tough. And then the second time she ran for governor for re-election, she was already too tough, and she had to show that she was likable. And so in a similar vein, Hillary Clinton, when she first ran for president in 2008, and I covered that race when I joined Time in 2007, she really ran as a man. She ran, with a lot of generals and, was campaigning next to her and talking about how she was able to take that 3 a.m. call. And when she cried, I don't know if you all remember the moment where she teared up in New Hampshire, and when she thought she was losing New Hampshire and her race was over, it was the moment where Mark Penn, her chief strategist at the time, freaked out and said, "There is no crying in politics. You have not only lost the race, you've lost your career. Like, no one will ever respect you again because you've cried." And it was actually the most authentic moment of that race for her, and she ended up winning New Hampshire on the backs of female voters. But this time around, she has been a lot freer to run as a woman, arguably, right? Like, so she can talk about equal pay. That's her biggest applause line. She can talk about childcare or paid family medical leave or paternity maternity leave. And yet she still faces the challenge, as Christine Gregoire did running for her reelection, of being likable. So Bernie can, yell at you for 40 minutes, and you're like, "Yeah, yell at me for 40 more," right? Like, he's, really fun to listen to, and he's, revolution and, starting a movement. And Hillary, faces a lot of challenges. When she yells, everyone's like, "Oh, my God, why is Mom yelling at me? She's so shrill. Why is she screaming?" You know, and these are the sort of subtle sexisms that women face. I mean, you cannot have a woman raising her voice without people saying, "She's so shrill," right? Or she's also boxed into a pragmatic zone in many ways, where Barack Obama in 2008 could dream huge and talk about the arc of the moral universe bending towards justice, and Bernie can talk about $15 trillion healthcare plans, but Hillary is forced into kind of the pragmatic role of Mom being like, "No, Bernie, we can't afford that jet ski. We need to save for college." And so these are the kind of subtle sexisms that women still face running for executive office in the United States, where you have to really show that you're likable. And that's a tough needle to thread, I think, for a lot of women, as we're seeing with Hillary. I am cusp millennial, sort of Gen X generation, and I think one of the cool things about writing the book was really discovering that my generation, millennial generation, is the first generation born just assuming the equality of the sexes. And it's only been as the millennials have aged into the workforce that they've realized that the assumed equality didn't really necessarily exist. And it's been kind of a wake-up call. And you see this sort of fascinating movement amongst millennial women with Taylor Swift demanding with her girl posse, demanding recognition at the Grammys, or Jennifer Lawrence asking for equal pay. You see these sort of millennials just beginning to engage in this sort of feminist movement and join the sort of ranks of feminism, which... and yet there's a big disconnect between that and Hillary and the idea of Hillary as the first female president. And so millennials assume that there will be a female president. That's one of, they just think, "Oh my God, there'll be a woman president in my lifetime, because why wouldn't there be?" What Hillary struggles to do is to say why it has to be her to millennials, to say what she would do differently and how she would govern differently and how she would represent them differently. But one of the cool things about millennials in looking at this and writing about this is that they are really changing our workforce, and millennial men to some degree are responsible for changing our workforce in ways that even millennial women are not. So women overall still make up 76% of the housework and child rearing in America. But millennials inverse that. Millennials women only make up 67%. So 30% of the first contacts in America today are actually dads for kindergartners rather than moms. As millennial men take on more and more responsibility, they want to be more and more involved in their children's lives and take on more and more roles in housework and child rearing. And so you look at a place like Silicon Valley, where they're horrific for women, generally speaking, and the advancement of women, but they're actually really good with men in terms of child rearing. So they've almost completely deconstructed this stigma of men asking for flexible working hours, of men wanting to be stay-at-home dads. So Silicon Valley, 50% of first contacts for kindergartners are actually men, and they lead the country in asking for more time off to do child rearing going to pick up, go to their kids' soccer games and things like that. When I was writing the book, I also was really heartened at the idea of critical mass. And so critical mass comes from, it's like a scientific term. It comes from science. It actually is the idea that it's the point at which a chain reaction can no longer be stopped. So in a nuclear reaction, for example, it's the point at which you can no longer stop the bomb from going boom. But it's been applied to sociology, actually, for decades. So when they integrated schools in the South, they actually mandated a quote-unquote critical mass of 20% of minority students in each school, because otherwise the schools just didn't work. And I kind of loved the idea. I had always assumed parity was this kind of pie-in-the-sky notion. I would never see it in my lifetime. And that, you know, and I never thought, you know, I just didn't really think about it as a journalist, but, and especially as somebody coming in when I did, covering the White House 13, 14 years ago, there were so few women. You just felt like we're so far away from these things. And I was really sort of delighted to find, not that parity is not important, because I think it is critically important, and then I actually have come to believe that we will achieve parity in my lifetime, but that I was sort of tickled to find that we could be heard at less than parity, that we could make our voices known at somewhere of like 20 and 30%. We could really have an impact and begin to change things. And once we got there, the whole universe changed for us. But I do think it is important to get to parity, and I do, and here's why I think we will get there in our lifetime. So women first came into the workforce in the 1940s, thanks to World War II. You remember Rosie the Riveter? She, like, women really, we would not have survived the war, the economy would not have survived the war, if women hadn't been brought in to bring in the crops and build the planes and build the boats that helped us win the war as all the men were off fighting. But it wasn't until the 1970s that that all the laws banning married women from working were fully repealed. Banning women from working without their husband's permission were fully repealed. And I also should amend that women clearly worked before World War II. It was just they were not paid. But it will be economic necessity that fully brings women into the workforce. By the year 2030, the baby boomer generation will have fully aged out of the workforce, and we will be short 26 million workers. It's kind of hard to imagine given the economic downturn we're just coming out of, but we are actually facing a huge demographic cliff in America. There are only two ways to solve that problem. One, you bring in a ton more immigration, which is really hard to imagine with this Congress. Or two, you bring women up to full employment. Now, that actually solves the gap by 23 million workers. It almost completely solves the gap. Women actually already have the talents to do this. They make up 50% of college degrees and more than 60% of graduate degrees. They're just not using the talents that they have. But this is not going to happen naturally. It's something that we will have to force a little bit. And so the next president, no matter whom he or she may be, will have to begin to push to bring more women into the workforce. And there are models that we can sort of look to in order to guide us. Europe reached this demographic cliff well ahead of us a few years ago, and their solution was to impose quotas. Again, that's really hard to imagine this Congress actually imposing. But there are other solutions. The 30% Club that I mentioned earlier that exists in New York is actually the sister to the 30% Club in Canada and the UK, which is a public-private partnership on the prime ministerial level, which actually really engages and brings in a lot of women thanks to the government's push to bring in more women to the workforce. But perhaps the best model is the somewhat unfortunately named program, the Male Champions for Change in Australia. I say unfortunately named, but I actually do love the idea because we're not going to do this by ourselves as women. It's not going to be the 5% of Fortune 1000 CEOs who are women who are going to bring every other woman into the workforce. You have to engage men in this process. You have to empower men in this process. And so Australia did it by challenging the Prime Minister of Australia challenged all of the CEOs of the country to very transparently report how many women they were recruiting, how many women they were training, how many women they were retaining after they left to give birth and then came back. And it ended up being an incredibly successful program. So in the 6 years that it's been in existence, they've actually increased female participation in the executive workforce from 27% to 47%. And it's been really powerful. Something like a quarter, 25% of all minors in Australia are now women, thanks to this program, which is kind of stunning. And And it's been really powerful, I think, because of the transparency. So one of the big hurdles I had in writing this book, and my endnotes are incredibly voluminous because I wanted women to have a whole arsenal to explain to people why they should be hired and why they should be promoted and all this sort of data and studies behind, look, it is such a great business plan to promote and empower women. And I found it amazingly difficult to actually collect all this data. And I wrote much of the book when I was a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard, and I had 8 amazing research assistants. And even with those researchers, we found it really hard to collect all the data because there really isn't anybody collecting all this data in America. And you would think it would be a no-brainer, right? Like, we would know how many women are in the workforce, but we actually don't. So it took, for example, for me to figure out that 30% of the administration in the upper level of the sort of middle and senior management were women, I had to talk to the 13 departments of the administration, the White House, and 4 labor unions to get that number, because nobody is collecting it. If you look at in the private sector, we know roughly overall how many women are in the executive workforce, but that's because the companies that report it are given anonymity to report it. So no company specifically reports it unless they want to, and you don't actually report it unless you are really proud of it, and very, very few of them are actually really proud of it. So the first step, really, for everybody is just being able to, like, let's start collecting the numbers. And that's a real challenge in America. Like, there is a surprising dearth of data about women in the workforce. It's kind of amazing. For example, just take, I have a chapter on women in policing. In an era of Ferguson, in an era of riots in Baltimore, why wouldn't you want more women in your police force? Women always look for a cerebral, verbal solution rather than a physical one. They almost never draw their weapons. Anise Parker, who is the mayor of Houston, actually commissioned a report on how many times people drew their tasers after Houston introduced tasers a few years ago. And in the first 2 years of that report, the female cops draw their tasers a grand total of 0 times compared to their men who'd drawn them dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of times. Men make up 98% of the excessive force cases in terms of for lawsuits in the country for police. Women are almost never drawn up in excessive force cases or charges. While at the same time, importantly, they still have used the same amount of regular force, which I think is really interesting. And yet, the last police agency or the last police association for women nationally that existed in America went defunct 2 years ago. There's absolutely nobody tracking the numbers of police women in America city by city, and each city is ad hoc. Some cities are great at it, other cities are terrible. So I guess what I would say is, in closing, the book, the real thing to do is really, like, and I challenge you as individuals, is to go and collect the numbers. And there's Generation W is a group that I've been working with. They are a nonprofit who sort of begin to challenge and empower women on local levels. They are collecting all this data. They have a scorecard that you can look up online, and you can start filling out how many women are in your police force, how many women are in your city government, how many women are on the boards of your local companies. Because without getting a sense of this data and these numbers, we're never going to get a sense of where we are and where we should go from here. And that's the first step to parity down the road. And that's pretty much the book. So I look forward to your questions. Thank you so much.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thank you again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.